Today's Teisho will be on case 75 in the Blue Rock Collection. Ukyu's Unfair Blows. Engo's Introduction. The sacred sword is ever in hand. It is death-dealing and life-giving. It is there, it is here, simultaneously giving and taking. If you want to hold fast, you are free to hold fast. If you want to let go, you are free to let go. Tell me how it will be when one makes no distinction between host and guest and is indifferent to which role one takes up. See the following. Main subject. A monk came from Joshu Osho's assembly to Ukyu, who said to him, "Where do you find in Joshu's teaching? What do you find in Joshu's teaching? Is there anything different from what you find here?" The monk said, "Nothing different." Ukyu said, "If there is nothing different, why don't you go back there?" And he hit him with his stick. The monk said, "If your stick had eyes to see, you would not strike me like that." Ukyu said, "Today I have come across a monk," and he gave him three more blows. The monk went out. Ukyu called after him and said, "One may receive unfair blows." The monk turned back and said, "To my regret, the stick is in your hand." Ukyu said, "If you need it, I will let you have it." The monk went up to Ukyu, seized his stick, and gave him three blows with it. Ukyu said, "Unfair blows, unfair blows." The monk said, "One may receive them." Ukyu said, "I hit this one too casually." The monk made bows. Ukyu said, "Osho, is that how you take leave?" The monk laughed aloud and went out. Ukyu said, "That's it, that's it." Secho's verse. Easy to call the snakes, hard to scatter them. How splendidly they crossed swords. Although the sea is deep, it can be drained. The kalpa stone is hard, but even the kalpa stone wears away. Old Ukyu, old Ukyu, who is there like you? To give the stick to another, that was truly thoughtless. So this story is about a monk who was a monk in the temple of Master Zhaozhu, Master Joshu. Osho means priest. A monk came from priest Joshu's temple to Ukyu. And when Ukyu meets this monk, he says, "What did you find? What did you learn from Zhaozhu, from Joshu? Is there anything different from what you find here?" The monk said, "Nothing different." So Ukyu said, "If there is nothing different, why don't you go back?" And hit him with his stick. Ukyu said, basically, "If you weren't blind, you wouldn't hit me like that." And Ukyu hit him three more times. And as the monk was leaving, Ukyu calls out and says, "Sometimes in life you get unfair blows." The monk turns back and says, "Well, you're the one giving the unfair blows. I wish I had the stick." And Ukyu says, here it is." So the monk gives Ukyu three blows and says, and Ukyu goes, "Unfair blows, unfair blows." And the monk says, "Well, one may receive them." And so on. That's the story. In our temple, in a Zen temple, in the Zen tradition, there is something usually on the altar which is called a keisaku or a kyosaku. And in Chinese, this is called the incense board. The Chinese version looks a little different from the Japanese version. The Chinese version looks like a long stick, a long thin paddle. It's pretty long, it's maybe 3 feet long. And it looks like a very thin paddle. When I was in school, it was illegal. By then, it was illegal in the United States for the principal to hit students. But a generation ago, in many schools in the United States, there was a big paddle hanging in the principal's office. This was usually in the elementary school. And it was often displayed on the wall so everybody could see it, and they knew that if they were bad, they would get a paddling from the principal. So this is a long stick, something like a paddle, and it is usually placed on the altar. The Japanese version is a little different. It's narrow at the handle, and then it flattens out toward the head. It too is about 3 feet long, maybe a little shorter than that. The keisaku or kyosaku is placed on the altar in front of the incense stick and the candle. And the person who is in charge of the Zen hall, the jikijitsu, will get up during the sit, and with his assistants, they will patrol the seated meditators. So usually at the beginning of a sit, the temple boss will get up and go up and down the altar. So he walks in front of you and would be looking at you and looking down at you with the stick. And then would go down the first row and go over to the second row and stop, and then go back down and then come up and do this several times and then sit down. So this is a classical Zen practice. In a Japanese temple, you better look out. You better not move at all. The jikijitsu is looking for anybody who moves. And if anybody moves even a muscle, you're going to get hit with that stick. And the stick is used in a particular way. There's a part of your back which is just below your shoulder blades. It's a big muscle that protects protects that part of your back. And people lean forward when the jikijitsu has selected you to be reprimanded with the stick. Basically, you're tapped on the shoulder, and you have to lean forward, and then it's like, and then you have to give him the other side, and then it's, you know. So in a typical Zen temple, there's this guy going, and you'll hear, you know, typical morning of Zen would be, you know, this, and then up and down, you know. Sometimes it's punitive, right? It's because somebody's moving, and you can also just volunteer to get hit with a stick. So I actually don't, as you know, we don't use the stick in here. And there's a complicated story behind that. When I was training with the web, I was jikijitsu. So my job, and I had been jikijitsu before when with Genki Roshi also. And my job was to keep the time. In a classical Zen temple, the teacher isn't the timekeeper. The Roshi actually usually sits where John is sitting, and the jikijitsu sits where I am sitting. And the Roshi comes in and has everybody's admiration. And the jikijitsu is the one everyone hates for making you sit so long. So they separate those functions. So the Roshi is the good guy, and the jikijitsu is, we say, good cop, bad cop, right? So the Roshi is always coming in and going, oh, that Jikijutsu, he makes you sit too long, that's terrible. But he secretly goes over to the Jikijutsu and says, make this one 40 minutes, okay? But this is part of the way temples operate, actually. So anyway, I was the Jikijutsu, so my job was to patrol with the stick. And there was a guy in our temple who came to sit. His name was Mick. And every day, I would get up every morning, and every other sit, just about, I would patrol. And I remember one afternoon, I was going down the tan, down the row, and we had a fair number of people in the temple we had built up in the mountains. So there was maybe, the rows were about twice as long as these rows. So there were about maybe 14 or 15 people on each side. And so you couldn't see down the whole thing, and I would be walking down, straightening people's posture and making sure no one was moving, and people would ask to be hit with the stick. And there was this guy at the end of one row who was literally, you know, like totally asleep on his feet, you know. And I had heard him in the Zendo. I was sitting in the Zendo that morning and I heard this you know, and of course, you know, this is, at the time I was, doing my very best to be a good Jikijutsu, you know, which is like being a cat chasing mice. So it would be, for a Jikijutsu to hear somebody sleeping like that, this is an outrage, you know. And Genki Roshi would have immediately, if I hadn't taken care of somebody sleeping like that, Genki Roshi would have jumped off the cushion, grabbed the keisaku and really blasted him, you know. So had learned to be outraged at this kind of behavior, and when I came to the end of the row and I saw this guy barely sitting up and just, I hit him with the stick. You know, I tapped him on the shoulder and he leaned forward and I should explain that the blow doesn't, there's no chance of injuring anybody. I've never even seen a bruise. It's just like a slap on the meaty part of your back. So anyway, I gave him four blows on one side, and there's a ritual way of hitting. You have to be very careful not to hit anything except this big muscle. And you feel with your hand first and then you strike. And then I went around to the other side, and I waited, and I came back, and there was Mick again. Only this time he was like fallen over on the ton. He was like, you know, literally like, it would be like in here, you look over and somebody's down on the ground just with his head on the zafu. So I woke him up, you know, I roused him and I hit him again. I went back to my, and I yelled at him. I said, "No sleeping, no sleeping, in this Zendo." Very Zen, very Zen. So I went back to my thing, and all through this sesshin, I thought this guy was trying to get my goat. You know, I was a very young man. I wasn't very smart, and I was a long way from finishing my training. I probably shouldn't have had this job at the time. But I understood this at the time as being a conflict, that this guy was in the temple and he was just flouting all the rules and was busily undermining my authority as it was. At the end of the sesshin, I investigated this person's situation. He was such a nice person. At the end of the sesshin, I was surprised to see that he was this very wonderful person, and also he didn't have any animosity towards me at all, even though there had been some friction. And I later discovered that this person was what you call a narcoleptic. So basically, when he was under stress, his body shut down. He went to sleep. This is an actual condition, narcolepsy. Sounds like epilepsy. He had a very interesting history. He was a seriously abused child, and his father used to beat him up and lock him in a dark closet, and sometimes even he would hang him upside down. This is really, it's unbelievable to think that a human being could do this to another human being, but you know, people inflict cruelty on others in the name of all kinds of good things, as I myself have done, including when I was Jikijitsu. So I was stunned to learn this from somebody in our group who was a psychotherapist and who was not a mixed psychotherapist, but when I heard about this, I literally felt like the ground was dropping out from under me. I don't think I've ever been so deeply ashamed in my life. And, you know, I never carried the keisaku again. I thought that was my karma, to not carry the keisaku. And we don't have a keisaku in here because of that event. And until I leave this body, and I hope in all future lives, I will never carry the keisaku again. That's a personal matter. You may practice at other temples where it's vigorously used, and many great compassionate teachers use the keisaku, but I myself do not. Interesting case, I think. You know, Mick was a wonderful human being. He had worked tremendously hard just to be a normal person. And he had put together a life for himself that was really kind of remarkable. He had some property outside of Seattle that he had turned into a kind of a paradise. We actually had a weekend sit at his house, which he had built himself. He was a very creative person, and he had built one of these dome houses. I don't know if you know these geodesic dome houses, but in the 60s and 70s, these were very trendy with the counterculture people. It's a certain kind of design that's very simple and sturdy. And he had built a series of these interlocking domes, or zomes, I guess they're called, out in this beautiful pine and spruce forest, and he had created a little lake. So you had to drive across the lake to get to his, I think he had about 10 acres, and he had built this little paradise, and there were ducks, and somehow he had come out of the depths of hell and created this wonderful paradise. And at some point he decided he wanted to do Zen practice. And he undertook the great challenge of, started at hell, and he was on his way to enlightenment. I really don't know how his story turned out, because a few years, he did practice with our group all the time I was there, and sometime later I finished my practice and left. But it's an interesting case, you know, interesting case. This issue of unfair blows. We don't have keisaku here, but we really don't need a keisaku, because life often is our keisaku, don't you think? A lot of the times things that happen to people are not what they seem to deserve. You know, I was talking with one of our members the other night, And I think I've mentioned this case already, but it's in my mind a little bit. This is a person who has a spouse who's in very ill health and has to carry that heavy burden. In addition, he started his career as an engineer, and when manufacturing jobs left the United States, he trained as a IT specialist, and then when those jobs left, or those jobs are leaving, he's a little bit older than I am, and he's facing unemployment in a year. So you have to ask yourself, you have to say that's a terrible, terrible situation to be in, you know. And to be 55, 56 years old and finishing your second career, right, and looking at uncertainty. And, I have recently known some other people who are undergoing similar kinds of challenges. There's a woman whose name is Peggy, who works for me in the English department. Works with me, and she is one of our real troopers. Her husband's a history professor, and Peggy is one of these people you can say, I'd like you to teach, would you be able to teach at 8 o'clock, 8:10, and on short notice say, could you teach this course? No problem, I'll do it, absolutely. You know, Peggy's the kind of person who would just say yes no matter what I asked her to do, and she'd do a good job. She'd get excellent evaluations, cheerful, friendly. So I actually didn't know this until recently, but she has lung cancer. And she isn't a smoker. It's one of these strange cases. How did she get lung cancer? I hadn't seen her. Somebody told me, did you know Peggy had cancer? No. And she didn't teach for us this fall. She came I was sitting in the chairman's office and we were talking, and she came to the door of the office. And I looked at her, and you know, she was clearly wearing a wig, and her face was very hollow from the chemo. And she was upset about something, you know, like her library privileges had been taken away from her because she wasn't teaching at Rutgers this semester. She's a part-time faculty. And she came in to see the chairman and complained bitterly. Clearly, the issue was really not whether she's going to have a library card, it's feeling connected to the institution, and so on. So, you know, she walked into the chairman's office and she looked at the chairman and she looked at me and she started complaining and she just burst into tears. And a little later in the day she called me up and said, I'm so sorry to have made such a fuss. And of course, she had nothing to apologize about. Anybody in that situation could behave that way, you know. But, you know, really wonderful person, has a little daughter, and may not make it. You know, these are unfair blows, yes? This is so much of life, these unfair blows. And on the cushion too, you know, we can say this is a no fair, no fair, you know. I remember I used to, I was very serious about, at one point I got very serious in my Zen training about dealing with this pain business, you know. I would go to these sesshin and I would be in a lot of pain and I wasn't practicing regularly. Eventually, I just decided that I was really serious about Zen. I wanted to do it with my whole being, or I thought with my whole being. And I began to practice regularly, sitting, 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 sitting. And I even started to practice full lotus and half half lotus and full lotus. And I can remember first time I tried to sit full lotus was I was down in New Mexico visiting with my brother-in-law. He had this beautiful adobe house that he was renting down near the river. It was just beautiful. And the floors were even made of packed mud. It was just a beautiful traditional New Mexico house. It was really, now it would be worth $1 million, but then it was just this little shack. And I would get up every morning and sit with the clock and pull my legs up into full lotus. And at first it was like 5 minutes was all I could do, and I'd be sweating, you know, it was hot, but I would be sweating. And I'd do 7 minutes, you know, next day 10, you know, try to build myself up. And I remember coming to Sesshin and being so bummed out because I seemed like I had more pain than ever. You know, I was just so bummed, as we used to say, so pissed off. You know, this is not fair. You know, I've been practicing and now I have all this pain. This is not fair. Unfair blows. And, you know, other unfair blows, we all get them, right, you know. I work with people who are very, very successful, and some of them are the most egotistical people in the world, and sort of selfish, egotistical, blah, 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 and you think, God, they're so successful, it's amazing. And you realize there's not necessarily a connection between somebody's being successful and somebody's being a particularly good person, you know. Unfair blows. So, you know, what do you do when you've given it your all, you've practiced and practiced and practiced, and you're sitting on the cushion and your legs hurt? It's clearly unfair. You know, how do you deal with that? I want to go back to the introduction because there's a phrase here that's very important. Engo's introduction. He says, tell me how it will be when one makes no distinction between host and guest. Now, in Zen, these two terms, host and guest, are very important. You know, when a person goes to visit somebody, that person is a guest, right? Person who visits, who comes and goes, is a guest. A guest comes and goes. The host is the one who always stays. The one who always stays is the host. See? Now, in Zen, this ability to be aware of host and guest is quite important. You know, most people are never aware of the host. They're always caught up in their role as guest. Most people just have mental events, and they're utterly caught up in their emotions, their thoughts, their experiences. When you begin to sit on the cushion and watch your breath, you begin to take a distanced view of what's happening on the cushion. So, you know, when you sit, you eventually become aware of your thoughts. You become aware of your emotions. You can see them coming and going. See, ordinarily, we aren't aware of our thoughts, we just have thoughts. We think something and it carries us along. We have emotions and we aren't aware of the emotion, we just have the emotion, we experience the emotion. So we're just mad, right? We're just thinking about something, you know. When you begin to do Zen, you begin to be able to see the emotion at a distance. You say, oh, I can see right now that I'm mad. I see that made me mad, see? This is a ability to become, to assume the position of the host. See, when you stop being carried by your thoughts and you look at your thoughts from a distance, you're assuming the position of the host. When you're carried along by your thoughts and your emotions, you're not aware of them, you're playing the role of the guest. So a lot of Zen practice is learning how to be the host and not the guest. So ordinarily we're the guest. We want this and we get it or we don't get it. You know, we expect this and it happens or it doesn't happen. We envision this and it comes to pass or it doesn't come to pass. This is the life of the guest. The guest lives in a world of changing phenomena. You know, this happens and then this happens and swept along. But there is something that doesn't change and that doesn't come and go. And that's the host. This is our true nature, true self. In Zen, we learn how we return to the host by gradually learning to adopt the perspective of the host. So, you know, when you're sitting on your cushion and you're in pain, or you're tired, or sick, whatever, this is not what one expects, right? This is an unfair blow, unfair. And unfair is always the voice of the guest, right? The guest comes and says, I don't like these accommodations, blah, blah, blah. But to be good at Zen, to be a real Zen practitioner, is learning how to play the position of the host. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath and you're feeling pain in your legs. If you follow that breath out, 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 it'll take you right out of yourself. And it'll take you to this place which is like the eye of a tornado, absolutely motionless, absolutely still, great stillness. See, this is entering into the domain of the host. Forms come and go. And those forms include physical sensation, they include emotion, they include thoughts. Practicing the way is learning to let them come and go without embracing them. Stop playing the role of the guest and play the role of the host. And you play the role of the host by entering that stillness, entering that unmoving point, that unmoving place that your breath takes you to. And when we do this, we find that everything gets larger, gets bigger, becomes broader. It's like stepping out of a tiny little closet and looking out at a huge expanse. You know, when we first encounter that stillness, that blankness inside ourselves, we may not be able to stay there or be part of it for very long. But the longer we practice Zen, the longer we stay in that blankness, the wider our perspective becomes. It's like seeing yourself at a great distance. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're maybe feeling tired or pain, feeling sorry about various things that are happening. When you step into the bigger perspective, see, all of this seems so unimportant. Now, I realize it's easy to say, but you can do it. You can do it in the next sit. You can do it right now. Follow your breath to U, to Mu Xin. Enter that stillness, that silence inside yourself. Circumstances really don't matter. Whether it's cold or it's hot, this is just form. whether you're sick or you're healthy, this is just, these are just shaped by conditions. This is just the chain of cause and effect. As long as you ride the chain of cause and effect, you will have ups and you will have downs. And to be alive in the realm of form is to be on the roller coaster forever. This is inescapably so. There is no resolution. There is no liberation in the realm of form. What could it possibly be? So, liberation is entering the big mind. Big mind, and the gate to the big mind is the breath, is mu. So you watch the breath and you ride the breath out, and it will take you to this still place. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. Now, with advanced practice, people forget to play the role of the host also. You know, playing the role of the host means entering deep mu-shin, deep u-shin, and staying there and staying there and staying there until you are completely unified with the perspective of the host. Some koans want you to become unified with the host, period. Some koans ask you to become unified with the host and then to look back at the guest. So some koans are asking you to notice something in the world of form from the standpoint of the formless. This seems very, very weird, very strange. You enter deep mu-shin, deep blankness. You stay there until your dharma eye is opened, and then the koan is giving you a hint about where you should look. Where you should look. It may be in the realm of the formless, the realm of that blankness. It may be in your own mind, but it may be in the world around us. The koan is asking you to notice some aspect of the moment from the eyes of, with the eyes of the host. If you are in deep mu-shin and you can't answer your question, your koan, it may be because you're not looking in the right place. You can't just stay in the formless realm. You have to look in the realm of form to answer your koan. So if you're not answering, maybe not looking in the right place. Look, look, look everywhere. Some koans ask you to identify with the host. Some koans ask you to see with the eyes of the host. And some koans will help you to achieve complete unity of host and guest, of mu-shin and this sound, this pain, this hunger, this fatigue, this sunlight, this beautiful snowstorm, whatever. And of course, all of this practice is designed to help us enter the host with our whole being. It's a little cold in here, we don't get enough sleep, it is sometimes our legs do get tired. All of this is a way of pushing us into the perspective of the host. If we are totally comfortable, totally amused, and so on, then there's very little hope that we will leave behind the role of the guest. So the beauty of this practice, the wonder of this practice, is that so many people so quickly enter the formless realm. And that's the work of more than 1,000 years of great Zen teachers in India, China, and Japan developing this way of training. So today is day 2. Don't dwell with the guest. Don't be a guest. Be the host. You can't will yourself to be the host. You have to enter through the door of breath and through the door of mu. go through that door and experience really and truly, you know, we all are human beings. My legs hurt too. I hope you're not disappointed if I say that. And my back gets tired, you know, absolutely. But don't dwell in the realm of guest. Be the host. It's absolutely fantastic. You know, we have a body. It needs food. It gets sick. It gets tired. Muscles produce, certain acids that create discomfort. But we don't have to stay there. It's always possible, always within the realm of our ability to ascend into this beautiful realm, this infinite realm. Please do it. Easy to call the snakes, hard to scatter them. How splendidly they cross swords, Ukyu and the monk, were both they both understood what it means to be the host. How splendidly they cross swords. Although the sea is deep, although the sea of obstacles is deep, it can be drained. How do you drain it? Breath by breath, breath by breath. The kalpa stone is hard. Kalpa is the an eon or a very large, long stretch of time. So the kalpa stone is hard, but it wears away. How does it wear away? One breath at a time. Old Ukyu, is there anyone like you? To give the stick, you gave the stick to someone else. You let someone else play guest and host with you, exchanging the roles. That was truly thoughtless. Now remember, when Zen masters write something like that was truly thoughtless, it's a compliment. It sounds like an insult, but he's really saying, you were far above discriminating mind. You were in the realm before thought, the realm of pure host. This morning, everybody did a wonderful job. The sitting, we don't have a stick. We don't have a stick because we don't need a stick. Everybody sits so beautifully. This morning was no exception. Absolutely wonderful sitting in this Zendo. We had started with a 40-minute sit. People cruised through it and finished the hour and a half. Marvelous. Really wonderful, very deeply moving, deeply moving to me to see people practice so sincerely. It's really a great honor to practice with all of you. So this wonderful beginning has laid the foundation for deep practice, deep practice. So now, you know, be the host, be the host. You are the host. No, you are the host. Just enter the realm of no thought. Enter the realm of no goals, no judgment. And you will find life more beautiful than anything you could imagine. You know, really and truly.